from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. Welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.
Hello and welcome to The Art of the Matter. I'm Travis DiNicola. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Baselli Walrab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
And I'm Sharon Gamble. Today I'll get the lowdown on the Museum of Miniature Houses.
I'll chat with author Betsy Blankenbaker.
And I'll get a preview of this year's Jewish Film Festival, and we'll have that arts calendar we call
What'll We Do? All that and more right after the latest news from NPR. Elaine Mancini was just checking out her new neighborhood when she moved to Carmel a couple of years ago. When she saw the Museum of Miniature Houses in the Arts and Design District, she didn't realize it was a first step to a new career. Sharon Gamble learned more about Elaine and about the museum's bicentennial exhibition.
So before we talk about the bicentennial exhibit, I want to hear the story of how you first learned about this museum. You and your husband moved to Carmel a few years ago, 2012, something like that?
Yes, the end of 2012. And I'm an inveterate local tourist. So when I go anywhere, I check out everything there is to do and see. And of course, I found the Museum of Miniature Houses because it's right in the Arts and Design District in Carmel. And it was closed when I first went there. So I put it on my list to go again because I grew up in Chicago.
I've been trying to place your accent. Thank you.
And every year we would go to the Museum of Science and Industry to see Colleen Moore's Fairy Castle and the Art Institute to see the Thorn Rooms. So I love those miniatures, and so I finally got to go to the museum when it was open, and I happened to be there during a workshop and happened to meet one of the co-founders, Suzanne Lansoff, and she gave me a private tour. So it was very cool.
Have you ever done work in miniatures yourself?
Not at all.
And you don't want to, I can tell.
I did. I made a miniature gallery for my brother because he's retired and gone back to painting. And he's has six paintings that are 30 by 40 inches, and which are large. So I made him a miniature gallery and shrunk his paintings down to about, mathematically, I don't know what it was. It was very hard to get the scale right.
Sure.
But it was something like a half an inch by an inch. And so it's in a little white crate with a red carpet and ferns and a bench and six paintings on the wall.
How fun.
And it's labeled Ed's Gallery 2015.
Oh, that's so sweet. You know, there's just something about, I mean, I'm not aware that there are any museums of oversized things anywhere. We don't work in scale bigger than us, but there's something mesmerizing about whether you're doing the work yourself or looking at somebody else's work. There's something mesmerizing about seeing real life, but in small scale.
That's right. It's very magical.
Yeah.
And everyone responds to the precision of it. So that a lot of men come to the museum kind of dragged by their wives or their family members. But once they're there, they're the last ones to leave.
That's
because they really react to the precision of the pieces.
There's some engineering chromosome that kind of kicks in for anybody, man or woman, looking at it. It's like, okay, so and it's kind of a brain teaser too. You have to stop and look at something, and even if the label says it's a certain scale, your body has to catch up to that and say, oh, that really does look right.
Well, we have some dolls that are the size of your thumbnail.
Wow, that's crazy.
And we have a set of Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs that are about an inch high that are hand crocheted.
Wow.
And I've had many crocheters stop in front of that and say, how did she do that?
And you're not telling, because that's part of the magic. You want people to just keep coming back. So the process of doing the bicentennial exhibit has to go back a while because you applied to be an official legacy project of the Indiana Bicentennial Commission. Where did the idea come from?
I was on the Bicentennial Committee for Hamilton County.
Uh-huh.
And that our first meeting was spring of last year.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what gave me the idea, because I thought of what we had, and we have so many things in our permanent collection that pertain one way or the other to Indiana history.
Mm-hmm.
So that gave me the idea. And then Hamilton County Tourism was very generous in giving us bicentennial grants. And then I applied for the official Bicentennial Legacy Project designation, and there you have it.
That's fantastic. That is fantastic. So since we're kind of early in the bicentennial process, I want to ask somebody who's actually doing one of these legacy projects, what does that gain you? It gives you publicity, and what sort of benefits does that bestow?
Mainly access to completely different audiences that may not have thought of coming to a museum of miniatures before. So that's the main benefit to us,
mm-hmm.
because we're on all kinds of websites and officially sanctioned state sites and so on. That we had a wonderful story on statehousefile.com
mm-hmm.
because of that. So it's opened up all new possibilities for us.
Which is those who've been on boards or otherwise volunteered for not-for-profits or work for not-for-profits know that down the road that also means, because you've broadened your audiences, you're going to broaden your funding opportunities through
Correct.
Individuals, through foundations and so forth. So congratulations. Way to go. So is the exhibit arranged chronologically?
No.
Okay.
It is a series of items from our collection mm-hmm. that pertain to something or other.
Mm-hmm.
It's in four different parts of the museum.
Okay.
Four different rooms. So we have a typical Indiana farmhouse. We have a replica of Levi Coffin's bedroom, where he had the hiding place for the runaway slaves, because Levi and Catherine Coffin helped 1,000 runaway slaves in their home.
Astonishing.
Astonishing.
Yeah.
And we have a quarter-inch scale miniature of a recreational vehicle.
Oh, to represent the industry from northern Indiana.
That's right.
Wait,
That's right.
Say that size again.
Quarter-inch. So if you had something that was 6 feet tall,
uh-huh.
a quarter-inch would be 1.5 inches.
I see. Okay. Okay. Wow.
To give you an idea.
Yeah.
It's very tiny and it's very sweet.
Oh, my God. You pick it up and put it in your pocket. But please don't. Which leads me to, I want to go back to some of the artifacts in the exhibit, some of the models in the exhibit. But are there, and I go back to the models I know the most, which are model trains, which have a handful of different scales that people are attracted to. Is that the same with miniature structures? I mean, are there an infinite number of scales that people work in, or do most people kind of settle on quarter inch, or are there two or three popular scales?
There are, I guess, I don't know by percentage, but most people tend to go 1 inch to 1 foot.
Because the math is easy, or
because that has a large variety of items that you can buy.
Because
no one can make everything in a house,
right?
Just like in real life, you can't be a cabinet maker and a glass blower and a musical instrument maker and a painter and so on and so forth. So there has to be access to that scale that you want,
mm-hmm.
and once you decide on the scale, of course, you have to stick with it. Unlike
right.
a dollhouse,
right,
where you can put anything in there,
where you can put your giant Barbies in a house that they would hit their heads on the ceiling all the time,
right?
As we all did, as girls did anyway, and some boys did when they were children, but
right.
But yeah, oh, that's a really good point.
And then popular scales are 1/2 inch and 1/4 inch,
uh-huh.
but we have some things that are 1/144 inch. I can't
oh
even
my
say.
Gosh!
You know,
that's tiny.
It absolutely tiny.
Wow!
Yeah. And that tends to be for structures.
Okay.
Not for a goblet.
Right, right.
You know, because that way you couldn't even see it.
Yeah.
So it tends to be for structures like a house
okay.
or a castle or something
yeah.
like that.
Yeah, cool. So I understand there's a replica of Major Taylor's bicycle?
Yes. Yes, that was commissioned, actually, by the museum several years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And Major Taylor, as you know, was an African-American speed cyclist.
Mm-hmm.
And he showed talent very, very early on, as many wonderful athletes do. But he was not, because he was black, he was not allowed to race in official races.
Mm-hmm.
For some reason or another, there was a race in New York and that he was allowed to enter, and that's when he broke his first world record. And I believe he broke 7 world records in his career.
Wow.
So we wanted to honor that, and we have a replica that is absolutely complete. Tires, chains, spokes, everything is absolutely complete of the bicycle that he used in those races.
Fascinating. So as your visitors view these displays, you know, you have great labels so they can get a little bit of the story, but I'm guessing it's your hope that they get turned on by something and want to go and learn more about that.
You know, yes.
More about Major Taylor, more about Elkhart and the RV industry or whatever it is.
Right.
Yeah.
And we have signs for the exhibit pieces, mm-hmm. but then we also have notebooks, which we always have. In every single room, we have notebooks with more information on any of the exhibits in the room.
Mm-hmm.
So we have expanded text on these things that are in the Hoosier History Told in Miniature exhibit. Mm-hmm. And several people have said that they're going to go down to or pass by the Major Taylor Velodrome.
Mm-hmm.
Because they kind of thought they knew what that was, but now...
Now they have more context.
Now they have more context.
Yeah. And speaking of racing, as we're having this conversation on the cusp of the 100th running of the Indy 500, that is honored in this exhibit as well.
Right. We have a replica, and that's on loan. That's, I think, one of the few things in the exhibit that we don't own. That's on loan, and it's the Marmon Wasp, which was the first car that won the Indy 500. That was driven by Ray Haroon.
And really stylish. I mean, sleek and it looks fast even when it's sitting still.
Well, it's a one-seater.
Yeah.
And most of the other cars were actually two-seaters so that the driver could have a navigator
mm-hmm.
to let him know what was happening around him. But Ray somehow or another managed to pull it off.
Do you have some favorite objects in the Bicentennial Exhibition?
Oh, I think one of them, again, which is on loan, it's a little cabinet of miniature depression glass and it's all of the colors that the depression glass was made in.
So the green, the pink,
so
the
green,
yellow.
Yeah, everything.
I love those.
The clear, amber, everything. And then the bottom of the cabinet, so it's a kitchen scene,
uh-huh.
all right, with a cabinet full of depression glass. And then at the bottom of the cabinet are hooks so you can hang your own depression glass cups,
Aww.
Your real size cups that you can use.
Oh, that's adorable.
It's adorable.
Yeah.
And very clever.
Yeah, and reminds us of the gas boom that created the glass industry in Indiana as well.
Right.
And I understand you fairly recently made the decision to extend the exhibit. It was going to close on Memorial Day, and now it's going to go through Labor Day?
Yes. Yes, we've had so many people calling and asking about it, and attendance is way up. And it's everything. We get so many multi-generational groups. It's just wonderful. And so the exhibit particularly appeals to them. I mean, our permanent exhibit does as well, but
sure.
It particularly appeals to these multi-generations. And so we've decided to just extend it through Labor Day.
Sharon Gamble with the Museum of Miniature Houses Executive Director Elaine Mancini. Their bicentennial exhibit runs through Labor Day. The museum is one of just a handful of museums of miniatures in the U.S., and it hosts thousands of visitors from throughout the country and a dozen other countries each year. Find the Museum of Miniature Houses at 111 East Main Street in Carmel and at museumofminiatures.org.
You're listening to The Art of the Matter on WFYI 90.1 FM Public Radio. A note to our listeners, sex and sexuality will be discussed candidly during this next interview, and it may not be appropriate for all listeners. Born and raised in Indiana, author and filmmaker Betsy Blankenbaker is well known for her documentary New York in the 50s, based on the book by Dan Wakefield. She's also written what she calls a sex spiritual memoir titled Oh, The Autobiography of an Orgasm, as well as two other collections of stories by other women about orgasms. Travis DiNicola spoke with her about her work.
Betsy, welcome to Art of the Matter. Great to have you here.
Thank you.
Real pleasure. I've been looking forward to this. Dan Wakefield has told me a lot about you. Of course, you made the documentary New York in the 50s based on his book, which is where I first learned about you. And that's a great movie worth checking out.
Thank you.
And but we're really here to talk about some of your other work beyond that, and specifically the three books that you have written about orgasms,
mm-hmm.
Starting with An Autobiography of an Orgasm and then your other two collections. So let's jump right in, and I'll ask you, why did you want to write about orgasms?
I did not want to write about orgasms. I wanted to have one. The first book opens with the line, I had my first orgasm when I was 36, which means I spent half my life faking it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's a funny line, but... I was terrified to write that line because it meant speaking the truth, and it meant speaking the truth about everything. And I was living in a world for a long time that you told different truths to everybody in your life, and I definitely was not ready to share that I had... been disconnected from my body since the age of 6 when I was first molested by a neighbor, and then a few years later by some kids on the street,
mm-hmm.
and a few years later, and it wasn't until I was 35 when my fifth child was a baby born halfway through the pregnancy, and it was a little boy that had died, and at that point the lower half of my body represented death. And I realized I had really been shut down my whole life.
Yeah.
And how you do one thing in your life is kind of how you do everything. So I was willing to take a really honest look at myself. But I also was doing it quietly. And I didn't even start the research until I was 45. It was at a point I was long divorced and realized I had a life that looked really good, but it didn't feel good. And I just took myself on as a research experiment and decided to see if, after not feeling anything, if I could, you know, allow myself to maybe feel something. And I did not expect to write about it. I did the research quietly for 5 years. And then once I started sharing...
You didn't set out to write a book.
No. And especially so many stories that even, you know, my closest friend from college didn't know. My mother didn't know. So it was really exposing a lot. My former husband didn't know. So it was exposing myself to a lot. But I realized I might not be the only one.
I will say that as I was reading your book, to me, the book seemed more about connecting with the truth and the real history of your own life than it did even about orgasms. You could sense that everything in here is so truthful and so honest and very frank. And not just the first sentence, but throughout the whole book, you can feel how difficult it is to reveal a lot of this, but... in the end, that's really what was necessary is acknowledging all these different things that you had, that had happened to you, that you had felt, that you had done, and were now working through.
Yeah. I think for me, a big thing was speaking up because from a young age, I didn't want to tell my parents when the neighbor molested me because I was afraid of what they would think about me. I didn't want to say something to even a close friend when I made the choice to get an abortion in college, and because I was worried about what people would think about me.
Mm-hmm.
I was living this life of like being a good girl, so everybody would see me that way, and yet on the inside I was seeing you know, really self-sabotaging myself with all of the bad thoughts of thought people would say about me. And it was really liberating to, with the book, to finally say the things that I felt were unlovable, unspeakable, unforgivable. And that's the place where I connected with other women and men, too, mm-hmm. who have written me letters from all over the world thanking me and telling me how healing this has been for them, because the odds are 1 in 5 of us in the U.S., if we're a woman, it's close to like 1 in 10 if you're a man, has experienced some sort of sexual assault during their lifetime. In the U.S., the number for women, and I think this is through the Kinsey Institute, is 1 in 5 women are diagnosed with sexual dysfunction. There's a reason those numbers match.
Sure.
And we're not talking about it. Instead, we go to the doctor, and the doctors diagnose us with depression and give us Prozac. And I'm not against that, but what that is doing is numbing you even more. Mm-hmm. And
can just continue to hide the truth.
Exactly. So I was ready to feel everything, both the pain and the joy, the grief and the ecstasy. And it's been very humbling. And I'll tell you, at the very end, I almost, before the first book, almost thought, well, maybe writing it is enough. I don't want to reveal this much of myself. And I called my daughter. I have 4 children in their 20s. And I called my daughter and said, maybe I shouldn't release this. And she said, if you can help one girl, one woman, it's worth it.
Well, and the response to your book really is what drove then the next 2 books, correct?
Mm-hmm.
In that so many women and men were responding to it that you ended up collecting their stories.
Yeah. So when the book came out, I was literally just going to – funny thing was, I released the book November 1st, 2014, and then I went to Africa for a month. It was pre-scheduled, but I was – you know, no, I didn't – you know, I didn't want to do PR. I didn't want to talk about it. I kind of wanted to disappear.
Yeah.
And – and then it was really sweet because people started writing me stories and telling me their stories. And I did not realize the things that I was most afraid of revealing about myself were the place where people connected. And they started telling me their stories, and they were so powerful that I asked for submissions. And so now it's an ongoing series. We've had 32 storytellers so far in 2 volumes. And it's like a chicken soup for the soul, mm-hmm. but for orgasm. But when I say the word orgasm, I'm talking about our soul. I'm talking about feeling our whole body, our whole life. And if we're disconnected from our orgasm, we're disconnected from our soul, from our body, from feeling everything.
The writing's very spiritual in many ways.
Yeah, I was. And that was a surprise, too, for me. And I really tell people it's a spiritual memoir. But it was just revealing the truths about myself. And I do have women that say, well, this happened to me. What do I do now? I want to feel my orgasm every time. And I go, the most important thing is just to start listening. Slow down and listen to our bodies. Let your body be your teacher. You do not have to do what I did, which was go work with orgasm experts in New York or go to workshops. The best research I've done since then, and I do have another book coming out about it, is I spent a year not working with any experts, not reading any books, not even dating anybody, because I had so many women say, well, I don't have a lover or a boyfriend or husband. Mm-hmm. And so I spent a year just being on my own, researching on becoming the expert on my body. And not only has it been at the age of 53 now, like the most essential year of my life, but also the most spiritual.
That's fantastic. And so you'll be writing about that in your next book? And
yes. Yeah,
it sounds like there may also be additional volumes of other people's stories?
Well, there'll be a follow-up to my first book, Autobiography of an Orgasm. And then there, I'm already asking for submissions for the anthology. And volume 3 will be put together later this year.
Excellent. Congratulations on that as
well. Thank you.
We just have a little bit of time left here. So I'm going to wrap this up by saying, you know, if there's one thing that you hope, you know, people get out of this book or approach this book with a thought or open mind, what would it be?
It would be that no matter what has happened to them in the past, that their body matters, their life matters, and Even if you've experienced damage or disconnection or judgment, it can be even from church, that your body is a messenger. And if we just stop to listen and appreciate it every day, it's sending us messages all the time. We just not need to stop to listen.
Excellent. Excellent advice. Betsy, thank you so much for coming in to Art of the Matter today and for sharing your work through these books. It's a real pleasure.
Thank you.
Travis DiNicola with author and filmmaker Betsy Blankenbaker. You can meet her at Indie Reads Books on Friday, May 13th at 6:30 in the evening. For more information, visit BetsyBlankenbaker.com, just as it sounds, BetsyBlankenbaker.com. Hey, Travis?
Yes, Sharon.
What is your mother's favorite adult beverage?
Oh, goodness. She does like her white wine, you know.
Okay.
It's very dry. It must be dry.
Dry white wine. Mm-hmm. Fantastic. I'll keep that in mind because we need to mix up a couple of things for this week's calendar. The first is a batch of margaritas
mix
for
up.
Cinco de Mayo.
Mm-hmm.
And the second is whatever your mama's favorite beverage is, because
exactly.
Mother's Day is this Sunday.
Don't forget.
Don't forget. We'll have some suggestions on our calendar that we call
What Do We Do? Yeah, some great things to do with Mom.
Indeed.
But it is May, so we can't ignore the race car in the room. There we go.
Oh, I think that was the F1 car. Sorry.
That's still pretty good.
Okay.
And so as part of the celebration, this is a very cool thing. Indiana Historical Society is putting Indy 500 images available online, including photographs taken from the very first race with the race's first official photographer.
I saw that. Yeah. That's too cool.
And so there's a whole bunch, including some panoramic images dating back to the first race in 1911 and a whole bunch of other photographs as well that you can check out online at the Indiana Historical Society, indianahistory.org.
Fantastic. Mm-hmm. Hey, if your mother is a gardener, pay attention. The Connor Prairie Heirloom Plant Sale is this Friday, May 6th from 4 to 7, and this Saturday, May 7th from 10 to 5. You don't have to get a Connor Prairie admission. Join your fellow gardeners and foodies to start your garden season outright with their popular heirloom plants, including tomatoes, peppers, herbs, and scented geraniums. And they'll have knowledgeable gardeners there to help you choose. Once again, that's going on this Friday. If you're hearing us Thursday night, you can go 4 to 7 Friday night, or Saturday, 10 to 5. You might just take your mom along so she can pick out her own plants.
Hmm, very nice. Hey, there's a big expo that's going to be going on at the State Museum on May 20th and 21st. State businesses, universities, organizations are all going to be celebrating their Hoosier history and heritage during the Bicentennial Expo. It's from 10 to 5 p.m. on both that Saturday and Sunday, May 20th and 21st, to honor our past and present. And there will be a lot of cool activities and with different booths representing different businesses, but you can also do things like participate in an at throwing, the Geo Corner, a paleontology puzzle, Potawatomi dice game, Civil War medicine, and a whole bunch of other cool things taking place at the State Museum. Excuse me, Friday and Saturday, not Saturday and Sunday. It's Friday and Saturday at the State Museum, 20th and 21st.
That is deeply cool. So I have something that is for a young mother next on the calendar. If you know a mother who also happens to be a composer, mm-hmm. age 35 or younger, listen up. The Indianapolis Symphonic Choir has announced its 7th annual, this will cool you off, Christmas Carol Commission competition as part of its commitment to the future of choral music. Submitted works must be, now keep in mind, the composer needs to be 35 or younger, male or female. Submitted works must be original, unpublished, not have been publicly performed, between 3 and 5 minutes long, and written for SATB, soprano, alto, tenor, and bass, mixed adult choir. They can be a cappella or use keyboard accompaniment. And if you're like, you're going too fast, Sharon, I can't write that all down, drop an email to commission@indiechoir.org, commission@indiechoir.org, to find out more. And those submissions need to be in to commission@indiechoir.org by August 31st. So look around in your contact list and see if you know a young composer who'd like to participate in this.
Sounds great. I know a lot of people enjoyed the Book of Mormon when it was here in town, and perhaps now you'd like to check out the Phoenix Theater's production, The Book of Merman, as in Ethel Merman. It's sort of a cross between the Book of Mormon and the First Lady of Broadway when you've got missionaries showing up to ring Ethel Merman's doorbell. That's right. Two Mormon missionaries ring Ethel Merman's doorbell, and it just goes from there. As I'm sure you can imagine, you can learn how to be a Merman. It is a parody. Shocking.
You think?
Book of Mormon opens up at the Phoenix Theater on May 12th, runs through June 12th.
So maybe your mom isn't into silly, goofy, a little satirical. Maybe your mom is into Shakespeare. Well, listen up, because this weekend at the Wells Metz Theater at IU Bloomington is the New Frontier special production, The King Lear Project. IU Associate Professor Murray McGibbon has worked on this, and it's being called the first original pronunciation performance of Shakespeare's King Lear since the 17th century. He's worked with a specialist named David Crystal, who's a prolific author, who's also served as master of pronunciation at the Globe Theatre in London. So all that is something rich and wonderful to behold, and you can find out about that by Googling King Lear at IU, and maybe take your mom to that.
Oh, that sounds great.
Yeah.
Hey, I want to remind people, of course, that this weekend is the 24th Annual Indiana Gordon Society State Show. That's right. It's out at the Boone County Fairgrounds. That's always one of our favorites.
And they're gorgeous.
They're gorgeous.
Gorgeous.
Gorgeous. Yeah. Nice, Sharon. Nice.
Sorry. Mm-hmm. Hey, don't forget, we're back to silly and satirical for a moment. Mm-hmm. If your mom likes musicals and you've caught her peeking at those tabloids at the newsstand at the grocery store, take her to Bat Boy the Musical, which is on stage now at Theater on the Square. It's a musical theater straight from the tabloids.
It's so funny.
It's very fun. The music is catchy, and it's the plot is based on a 1992 supermarket tabloid story about a half man, half bat. I'm not going to tell you anymore. Just go see it. More information at tots.org. Bat Boy the Musical.
Hey, maybe another great idea for your mom for Mother's Day is to take her to see Guys and Dolls at Beef and Boards.
Oh, I love
so
that.
So there
show.
You get dinner and a theater in one fell swoop.
Yeah.
If you need a last minute idea for Mother's Day, this may be it. Great, great musical up at Beef and Boards Theater, and dinner is part of it as well, of course. Guys and Dolls runs through May 15th.
And he's got the horse right here, and if the weather is clear, there's a guy who says. Sorry, those patter songs get stuck in your head. Continuing on the theme of things you can do with your mom, Phantom of the Opera at Murat Theater at Old National Center through May 15th. We really don't have to tell you about that plot, but beautiful,
one,
beautiful
yeah.
music. Yeah, yeah.
The opening of The Dubious Luxury of Ordinary Men at the Harrison Center, Philip Campbell's new show. It opens on Friday the 6th. If you're listening to us Thursday, make sure you go check it out. If you're listening to us Saturday, well, you can still see the exhibit all through the month of May. Some really great work that Phil is doing, carving and cutting wood, making these sort of sculptural pieces, but they're on the wall, two-dimensional, really gorgeous work. Again, The Dubious Luxury of Ordinary Men at the Harrison with Philip Campbell.
Your mom is more athletically inclined? Take her to the IMA for the artist-designed mini golf course.
Oh, so fun.
How fun is that? And if you take her on Thursday through Sunday, you can take her to the clubhouse, that offers refreshments from King David Dogs and Sun King Brewery.
Excellent.
So a lot of fun for Very mom good. And for you, too.
Of course. Well, you can always learn more about local arts events to take you and your mom to at indiearts.org/guide. The Arts Council of Indianapolis' Indie Arts Guide website, or just listen to Sharon and I next weekend on that calendar we call
What'll We Do?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202. Or you can email us at artofthematter@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on wfyi.org.
Indianapolis's third annual Jewish Film Festival features movies about subjects as diverse as classic delicatessens and Hannah Arendt. Sharon Gamble invited co-producers Bob Epstein and Stan Springer in to learn more about this multi-venue event that runs from May 12th through May 21st.
So before I turned on the microphone, you guys were having a playful little interchange about who's going to talk about which film. You clearly get along well. How did you become co-producers of this festival?
Well, go ahead.
Well, we've known each other through Congregation Beth Shalom, and Stan and I just have a lot of things in interest. He and his wife are both interested in opera. I've actually had an interest in opera. My mother used to be on the Metropolitan Opera Guild. Had Roberta Peters in our home.
Wow.
And Robert Merrill. Our favorite Italian restaurant in my hometown used to host Enrica Caruso way back when. So,
what's your hometown?
Pompton Lakes, New Jersey. The restaurant is called Berta's Chateau, actually owned by Peter Bernstein. His grandmother was Piera and Santina Berta, and it's a great Italian restaurant.
Oh, lovely.
Yeah, so that's the history of. And so anyway, Stan and I get along great.
Yeah, we're a little bit of opera buffs from that standpoint. We know each other pretty well from that and our relationship in the Jewish community. So,
what does it mean to be producers of a film festival?
What it means is doing everything.
Well, that's glamorous, huh?
raising money, licensing the films, selecting the films, usually with a group. We met this year at Stan's home and looked at maybe 20 or 30 films. I probably have, for the years past, have previewed as many as 200 films.
I remember this from past conversations. There is hardly a film that comes out that you don't see.
That's true, although, unfortunately, right now, when I looked at the paper, I'm not crazy about too many of the films that are here right now. I stay away from action films. I stay away from very violent films, but yeah. I like dramas.
Yeah.
And I have probably 2,000 films, either DVD or VHS, in my home.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. So how do you come up with the little selection committee that helps you decide?
Well, we've reached out to a lot of different people within the Jewish community, and then there are some that aren't Jewish also that are involved in our committee. What we do is we kind of poll people, see if they have interest to get involved with our group, and that's what we've basically done. And we've pulled together a pretty good group of people that have done that. And obviously the interchange between all of us has been all good for the community and for
sure.
The program. So.
And you just said something I want to circle back to, which is that the point of the festival is to offer new insights into the human condition, in particular Jewish heritage and the Jewish condition, but not exclusively, right?
Exactly. What we're trying to get is to open the community more to the Jewish community that is pretty large here in the city that a lot of people aren't probably aware of.
Sure.
And consequently, there are major Jewish film festivals across the country.
Yeah, they're about 60 of them.
Oh,
right?
Yeah, all the major cities. And Indianapolis didn't have one up until 3 years ago when we started this. So having a chance to put Indianapolis into what everybody else is doing is good.
Yeah.
It gives us the opportunity of being part of a major city also. And we decided to add this to our to the city, and it's been great for us so far.
And it's clearly found a willing and able audience. You had more than 1,000 people attend last year.
Yeah, we did. We had a great crowd last year. It's grown significantly from the previous year, and we like to think it has something to do with the community getting involved, and that's what we're going to keep trying to strive for, is to grow that from our community base.
And I like that you use different venues around the city as well. Yeah. So you have we won't be able to get to all of the films, but I want to pay special attention to a film that's about Theodore Bekele and what a storyteller he was. Stan, I think you
well, yeah, I want to let Bob tell more about. Yeah, this is a great, great film, and it's about a little bit about his life and a little bit more that Bob's going to give you on that.
Well, it compares Theodore Bekele to. One of the old Jewish poets. And we were actually trying to get Theodore Bekele here last year when he was ill. He died last year.
I remember,
so
yeah.
we could not, obviously, get him here. We have his wife coming from Los Angeles, however, Amy Bekele, and she will introduce the film and talk about their life together and Theo's life together. He was, by the way, one of the wonderful Tevyes in on Broadway, of which there were many. I remember seeing Zero Mostel, who opened that. So I think that
it goes a lot about his relationship with Shalom Aleichem, which is a poet and a writer back in early late 1900s.
Yeah, I think so. And actually, Fiddler was based on a theme written by Shalom Aleichem.
Right.
I'm sorry, late 1800s.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's an intermixed story of how Shalom Aleichem and Bekel were intermixed throughout their whole life.
Aww.
And his play upon that guy's history,
how
that
lovely.
Man's history.
Yeah. Great warm story about somebody's a big life.
Mm-hmm. Sharon, before I forget, for those that want to look at the entire schedule, they should go to www.IndianapolisJewishFilmFestival.com, from which they can also buy tickets online, or they can do that at the door. And they, while we're on this subject, the first film is the Broadway musical, A Jewish Legacy, which is free to the public. That's the opening film, which is Thursday, May 12th at the Haston Hebrew Academy.
Mm-hmm.
It's free to the public, and it's a great film. It shows the great input of many Jewish musicians and writers to develop Broadway, so to speak.
Sure, all the way from Irving Berlin through the Gershwins, Richard Rodgers, Leonard Bernstein, Stephen Sondheim, stellar folks.
As the film indicates, that one of the few that was not Jewish happened to come from Indiana, and that was Cole Porter.
Well,
Cole
he's
Porter,
allowed.
He was not Jewish.
Yeah. He was in good company. I'm really intrigued by a film called Fill the Void. Can you tell us a little bit about that one?
Go ahead, Bob. It's a
Fill the Void is an Israeli film that's won many awards, and it is about an 18-year-old girl, young woman, that was forced to marry her brother-in-law, to be, so to speak, who's because her sister died.
Mm-hmm.
So in Orthodox tradition, she's the next in line. Well,
right.
She has another love. So it's a triangular story of the Orthodox, whatever, and it's a lovely film.
So it's...
And I won't tell you the outcome.
Please don't. I don't want to know. I want to wait and see the film. Speaking of complication, listeners of a certain age will remember Hannah Arendt's writing in The New Yorker, and you've got a film about her.
It was actually there was an article in The New York Times last week about Hannah Arendt. It's a very controversial film because she took an opposite position about Eichmann, which got a lot of notoriety. The film is probably the most controversial film that we have actually in the lineup. So we try to have a mixture of, you know, the happy, like the Broadway musical, mm-hmm. and the Bekel, which is a very upbeat film. In this case, Hannah Arendt is not quite like that. It's very intellectual.
Thought-provoking.
Uh-huh. Right.
Guaranteed to make people want to go and have a cup of coffee after and talk it through, talk about it.
Definitely. It is one that people will leave the theater and sit down, as you say, having a cup of coffee to say, what did we see?
Mm-hmm.
And what is this all about?
You know, speaking of more serious topics, God's Slave could not be more timely. It's a view of international terrorism.
True. And for those that don't know about the film, it's about the bombing of an Argentinian synagogue many years ago and by some Arab terrorists. And actually, we've asked Dr. Pierre Atlas of Marian College, who writes frequently on this topic, to preview the film and to give his view of international terrorism as we sit here today.
Hmm.
So I think it'll be a very meaningful discussion and then to be followed by this very interesting film, The God Slave.
And if Dr. Atlas's name sounds familiar, it's because you probably read him regularly in The Star.
Yes,
yeah.
And he has actually spoken to our group. We had the first year we had almost 200 at one of our films.
Mm-hmm.
And he was the speaker before the film. Remember what the film was that he...
Wasn't previewed? That the story about the bombings in the... Or no, was it about the Moscow... Boy, you've got
I'm not
me.
Sure.
I've forgotten already.
I've forgotten already.
You've watched so many fabulous films. I can understand
but
how
he
they
did,
would blend
he did
together.
Speak, he did speak to our group.
Yes.
And he was very well received.
Yeah,
yes.
Good. Nikki's family. Tell us about Nikki's family.
Wow. Wow, what a great story. I think many people probably are familiar with it because it's been posted on Facebook many times mm-hmm. and many different places. It's about Nicholas Winton. Nicholas Winton was a famous man that became very famous later in his life because of what he did with the Holocaust situation. In Poland, there were a lot of young children that were able to be extricated from Poland purely from this guy's generosity and his ability to finagle things and get past the Nazis and get the children into, mostly into England, but some into other parts of Europe.
Was he British?
He was.
Yeah.
In fact, he became Sir Nicholas. Mm-hmm. He was appointed that title somewhere within the last few years.
Yeah. Nicholas Winton is what's known as an honorable Gentile. That, for those that don't know what that term means, is after the Holocaust, probably more recently in the last 10 or 15 years, they have found many Gentiles, whether they're German or Polish or English, that saved Jews during the Holocaust.
Mm-hmm.
I had an example of that myself. I was in Latvia last year in the capital city of Riga, and someone said, "You've got to go to the Japanese embassy." So I went to the Japanese embassy, and there was the consulate general there during the war did the same thing that others had done. He wrote visas and got maybe 10,000 Jews out of Lithuania and Latvia. I never heard this story before. And when I came back, I bought several books about this guy's life. He was Japanese.
It makes you wonder how many other stories, untold stories, there are out there.
No, there's a lot. I mean, Nicholas' family, the movie itself is very, very thought-provoking and very warming.
He saved nearly 700 children.
Yes.
That's astonishing.
Yes, it's astonishing. And the amount of children that were at you'll see the movie, but he does get to meet up with a lot of these children later in his life. In fact, a couple years before his death.
Mm. Mm-hmm. How wonderful.
Again, Sharon, for those that are just tuning in, tickets are available online, www.IndianapolisJewishFilmFestival.com. You can get a further review of each film and order your tickets online, or you can come to the door and buy them.
And I saved the most delicious film for last. You may have wondered why I went out of chronological order, but I saved Deli Man for last.
Yeah,
tell us about Deli Man.
What a great, great movie. I just love this show. It's fun. It's just fun as can be. It talks about a specific deli proprietor. I'm not going into all the details, but in New York City and how he's developed into his start, and then he moves. So there's a lot of interesting U.S. History here in the deli industry, and we're going to have a cooking contest right before the showing of the film, where everybody that comes to the film will be able to have a little taste of some Jewish delicacies.
And what are the items that we're going to have?
We're going to have knish, we're going to have a kasha salad, we're going to have kugel, and for the sweet taste, there's Hamantaschen. Yes.
Oh, yes.
So we're going to have all of those things that is so much fun and has a lot of Jewish heritage.
And that'll be at the Landmark Theater, right?
Yes, the Landmark Theater. Sometimes people like to call it Keystone's Arts Theater. So it's the same one.
And there'll be a special appearance by?
Well, we're going to bring in, tying all this together, our own deli man. Shapiro's, as everybody knows here in town, has been here forever. Everybody loves to get a corned beef there. Oh, my God.
Yeah.
That's so wonderful. And what we're going to do is have a little film about our own deli man. Brian Shapiro will be performing for us in that film. And Bob's going to take that over and do that. How are you going to do that, Bob?
We're going to meet with Brian at the downtown restaurant.
The real Shapiro's.
Yeah, the real one.
Forgive me, Carmel.
And, you know,
and the airport.
As I told you, Sharon, my family, my father told me that he had eaten there as early as 1920, even though the restaurant dates, I think, to 1905.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to ask him about the history of his family, Max Shapiro, Ann Shapiro, and many others that some of us in this community will remember. Stan, what date is that film?
That is May 18th. That is May 18th at the, again, the landmark Keystone Arts Theaters there up there in Keystone at the Crossing.
And you just go online to Indianapolis Jewish Film Festival and get your tickets for that.
That's
and
right.
And if you're already looking through your recipes, you can find out more about the cooking contest on the Facebook page.
Right. And actually, Sharon, we brought a couple samples for you to try today, but we're not giving out recipes. I've been a cook, too, in my life, and I always hold back at least one secret ingredient.
Oh, that's you clever. That?
Well, I might have been known to do that. I don't try to do that, but I
unconsciously, I forget an ingredient.
Yeah, that's right.
Careful, the splendid table is listening. Gentlemen, thank you. Break a leg. I hope you exceed your last year's attendance.
Thank you, Sharon.
Thank
appreciate
you, Sharon.
It.
Sharon Gamble with Bob Epstein and Stan Springer, co-producers of the 3rd Annual Jewish Film Festival. The festival runs May 12th through May 21st at multi-venues. You can learn more at IndianapolisJewishFilmFestival.com. Again, IndianapolisJewishFilmFestival.com, or search for the festival by name on Facebook. Thanks for joining us today. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Vaselli Wallrap Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com. Please listen to The Art of the Matter next week, Thursday at 8 p.m. and Saturday at 7 a.m. when I'll find out about a special art exhibit in Speedway this month.
I'll visit with Norman Burns, the new CEO of Connor Prairie.
And I'll get a preview of the first Poetry Carnival event. Plus, there'll be that arts calendar we call
What Do We Do? So please listen next weekend to The Art of the Matter here on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Central Indiana and Indianapolis. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. Today's show was edited by Melissa Davis and produced by Travis DiNicola. The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.